Just pull the mic right on up, and here we go. That is, once again, Sinead O'Connor, Fire on Babylon. Sinead getting pretty adamant about what should happen to Babylon. Okay, here we are.
I love Sinead O'Connor.
She's all right, huh?
You know what my favorite song of hers is?
Which one is that?
Lay Down Your Arms.
Yeah.
Her reggae album.
Wow.
That's an awesome
song. I'm not too familiar.
It's fantastic. If you've ever
I'm going to write it down right
if
now.
If you've ever heard reggae with an Irish lilt, you'll love it.
Well, here's what's interesting about that is that I happened to play a song by Sinead O'Connor last Monday. And it's a cover of Bob Marley's song War. Do you know that one? And it's all with the reggae in the background and then Sinead O'Connor with her wonderful little. But that song, it's interesting. That song was actually, the lyrics were taken by a speech by the Ethiopian emperor Haile Selassie, who is kind of the god of the Rastafarian religion.
Yeah.
Who, interestingly enough, was sort of a backwards emperor in so many ways. He was involved with some pretty brutal suppression of the Eritrean people in the northern provinces of Ethiopia. And was funded by the United States militarily in that war. It was pretty brutal. We're not going to get into that, but he's still regarded as somewhat of a savior in so many other mythical and sort of symbolic ways. However, that speech was absolutely amazing because he's saying, until the philosophy that holds one race superior and another inferior, there will always be war.
Yeah.
So really pinpointing racism as the underlying theme of a lot of wars, particularly in Africa, I think. So I digress, but I just wrote it down. Lay Down Your Arms, Sinead O'Connor. Now, is that the album or a song or both?
I think it's a song. I'm not sure what the title of
the album
is.
Yeah, it's a whole album in reggae?
It's a whole album of reggae.
Oh.
And, you know, there's all kinds of just great lyrics on that album.
I just learned something new. And so did you all, our listeners. We are here on the Monday Afternoon Show. We have Phoenix and Joseph. Now, Joseph, I have Olajack. Am I saying it right?
You are.
Yes. Joseph Olajack. And are you a Quaker?
I am.
Nice.
I am. I'm a member of the old Chatham Quaker meeting.
Yeah. Wonderful place.
A beautiful spiritual community.
Yeah.
Just all-inclusive and, you know, really welcoming.
And tell us when the Quakers moved to Old Chatham. A little historical background here. A couple of years ago, was it?
Oh, like,
in the 80s?
It was more than a couple of years ago.
How old is that house?
I know that Powell House was given to the Quakers in the early 60s by L.C. Powell.
Mm.
And I believe it was at that time that a meeting was established there, and then we just built the Quaker Meeting House across the road from the LCK Powell House.
Probably 4 years.
Not that long ago, about four years ago. So it's a beautiful structure. It's a post and beam structure that has beautiful cathedral ceilings. It's just delightful to be in there.
Amazing. I was on a job for a couple of years when I moved back to the area up in East Chatham, building a straw bale house for some Quaker folks up there who you probably know.
The Quaker Intentional Village.
Yes.
Eric Baer and his brother Jens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Close friends.
Yeah. So that big straw, we call it a straw bale mansion. It was kind of more, it's not really a cottage, you know, but it was a wonderful job to be on. Learned a lot on that one.
Yeah.
The masonry stove, the whole thing. So, so the Quakers moved to the area. I mean, they've been in this area since the 1700s. They've been around. This history goes way back, and they're noted for their opposition to war in particular.
Absolutely.
And they did not hold slaves. Is that correct?
Well, that's not entirely true.
Oh, wow.
There were some slaveholders. And in fact, in the 1700s, there was a Quaker who, I can't remember his name, Benjamin. My Quaker history is a little shoddy. I have to apologize for that. But I saw that in the New York Times, there was an article about this Quaker who lived in a cave somewhere in either the Adirondacks or the western part of New York. And he went to either the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting or some other large gathering of Quakers. And he had a leather pouch full of blood. And he took it out during meeting, and he sprayed it on the Quakers who were slaveholders.
Whoa.
And he basically stood up and said, you guys are a bunch of hypocrites. you need to change. And that was a huge, like, big deal in the Quakers at that time. Mm. And it really woke them up to, you know, human rights and stuff like that, the ones that hadn't sort of come along. And it was just a great story. You can check it out in the New York Times.
Yeah.
Huh. But our history of being pacifists, and I say that, you know, in a qualified way, even though we're a peace loving people, we're not passive in any way. We're pretty active in terms of, you know, speaking out against war. It started with George Fox. He was the guy who started the Quakers in England. And when Cromwell went against the crown, Cromwell tried to co-opt the Quakers to fight with them. Mm. And the Quakers were like, no, we're not interested in picking up arms. And that was one of the times George Fox was in jail. He actually spent about 14 years in jail at different times because he wouldn't, you know, fight for this or that group.
Yeah.
But it goes back to the origin.
Yeah, interesting. I go through my birthdays and anniversaries and stuff, and that's part of what I do for the show. It's like, today's Independence Day in Mauritius. Who would have thought? But it's also in this year, today, in the year 295 AD, Maximilian was beheaded for refusing military service in Thavesta, North Africa. I guess this would have been the Romans. And I don't know if it was the former Emperor Maximilian or which Maximilian it was. However, he's quoted as saying, you know, he's a Christian and he's forbidden to be a Christian, but he's also, as a Christian, forbidden to go to war. And was beheaded for it. So that's an anniversary today. I like to celebrate those. But the tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience, of refusing military service, goes way back. Here you have 295 back in the human consciousness. Saint Francis of Assisi, you know, it just goes on and on and on. Some of these saints, you know, quit the Roman army and became true Christians, which is non-war fighting people. So
picking up arms, I think, is a very important thing to not do. And I think the next wave of consciousness that will come across to people is that they're going to stop supporting war financially. Because one of the big things that I'm aware of is that, you know, we're approaching April 15th, which is tax day. And about half of our income taxes will support the military in some form or another. So it's not just, you know, will you go and fight? Because we have an all-volunteer army now. So it's not like there's a draft where people can say, hey, I object and I'm going to be a CO, conscientious objector. They're conscripting our dollars for the same thing.
And they're paying some good money for some bad people to go kill, too. The mercenary private contracting aspect of our military has now exceeded the voluntary part, I would have to say. Like, if you look, I was reading an article, it was a book by Rachel Maddow called Drift, and just talking about the military-industrial complex and where it's gone over the past recent years, how it's just become inflated into this massive multiple trillion dollar machine of craziness, which is mostly more than 50% private contractors. So these guys are just mercenaries. These are like the paid Roman, like coin seeking.
Privateers.
I don't know. As a recent movie, Phoenix, or?
Dirty Wars.
Jeremy Scahill.
Am I supposed to do
this? Yeah, put on your your mic's working. Just talk right into the mic there. And yeah, this has to do with Jeremy Scahill, right?
Is that the right?
I think it is, yeah.
That was amazing.
It's a documentary.
Eye-opening. Did you see that?
No, but I'm familiar. I haven't read the book either. It's based on the book by Jeremy Scahill, which basically takes apart this whole new modern war on terror and the deep, dark secrets of private contracting.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
So this is the documentary movie.
Yes, amazing.
Probably a few years ago it came out. Okay.
I just saw it in the last year, I think.
Good stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's eye-opening. Yeah, like you're like, whoa.
Mind-blowing.
And, you know, the thing about it that's might be disturbing for some people is that once you know it, you can't unknow it. And if people have a conscience, which I believe all people have a conscience, once you discover these things, you're going to want to do something about it, whether it's to learn more or to actually get out there with a sign in the street mm-hmm. and do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Speaking truth. Well, we have something coming up, and partly what you want to talk about, which is this weekend on March 18th, which is that Saturday or Sunday?
That's a Sunday.
It's this Sunday. So what is happening up at the Quaker community in Old Chatham?
Michael Mears, a British actor and Quaker, it has created a one-man play called This Evil Thing, which looks at conscientious objection in Britain during World War One. And he plays all the characters in the play, and he basically goes through and shares historical facts about what was going on in Britain at the time. What happened to people who decided not to pick up arms, and the response, the social response at the time. Mm-hmm. So I haven't seen the play yet, so I don't really know that much about it. But it's gotten wonderful reviews, and I think Phoenix might actually have a little something to read on it.
Yeah, I have a little bit more of information that went out on our Quaker newsletter. So it says, This Evil Thing is the compelling and inspiring story about conscientious objectors in the First World War, men who said no to war, a rarely told story involving a dizzying journey from a chapel in Yorkshire to the House of Commons, from an English country garden to a quarry in Aberdeen, from a cell in Richmond Castle to a firing squad in France. Michael Mears portrays a gallery of characters from conscientious objectors to army generals, from prime ministers to world-famous mathematicians with breathtaking physical and vocal dexterity. This highly original piece of storytelling uses verbatim testimonies, a multi-layered sound landscape, and vivid visual imagery.
And this is all happening this weekend.
This weekend. And Sunday people, the 18th. And after the show, people will have an opportunity to engage in a dialogue with Michael Mears and anybody else who's there in the meeting. I think it's going to be a really... We always have very rigorous debates, which is nice. So if you've got a point of view, whether it's pro-war or anti-war, we welcome you to come.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'll just add, just to correct a little, I wouldn't call it a debate. So, right? In the Quaker
right.
fashion of sharing, there's a tradition of everyone having the opportunity to be heard.
Yeah.
And not really debating each other, but more like doing what we can to actually hear each other and share our own take on things.
That is so true. Yeah. Very good point. The debate was the wrong word.
Yeah.
I'm going to own up to that.
Yeah. Well, there's some people maybe who want to debate or feel the urge to debate because they want to say, what about the war on terror? What about Nazism, fascism? How do you defend yourself? And all, like, want to debate. But
sure.
To come to one of your meetings, which we've been longing to do for a while, we haven't made it up there yet. But it's a real lesson, I can imagine, in communication and listening, deep listening. And then talk about your Quaker meeting also. Tell us about the Quaker meeting.
I'd
do
like
you mind?
To speak
yeah,
to
can
that.
You
That's
go
okay.
ahead? What is the Quaker meeting? Does it happen once a week?
So I'm not actually a Quaker.
Okay.
And I'm very aligned with Quaker spiritual practices.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my own long serpentine spiritual journey, which has covered a lot of different spiritual experiences and trainings. And it's very interesting to me that I found a sense of a spiritual home at the Quaker meeting house. Part of that is, like you emphasized earlier, Joseph, is that literally the sign says all are welcome. And we mean it. We actually mean it. It's not just fluff. And during a Quaker meeting for worship, there are different kinds. There are programmed and unprogrammed. And if it's programmed, there is a wide variety of options. And if it's unprogrammed, they're often quite similar from what I understand. So in ours at the Old Chatham Quaker meeting, we gather at 11 o'clock on Sunday, which I like to say is very civilized. And that's a wonderful appeal in and of itself. And all people are welcome. First timers, people who were born into a Quaker family, and everything in between. And we sit in an active silence, listening for guidance. And that could be from what someone would refer to as God or goddess or spirit or the divine or nature or their higher self or love or peace. You know, it's like the each person has the freedom to name that for themselves, and that we're actively listening for spiritual guidance and messages, which is referred to in the Quaker tradition as vocal ministry.
Yeah.
And then if a person receives a message, there's a process of discernment. And the person is to get clarity about, is this a message that's intended for the whole community? Or is this for me? And if it's a message that's it's clear to them is intended for the whole community, then they stand up and they share that verbally. And if it's for them, then they receive it for themselves. And so each Quaker unprogrammed meeting for worship that we have in Old Chatham is different. They'll never be two exactly the same. And in fact, there's probably never the same group of people there every single Sunday either.
That's neat.
That's really neat. Partly because we have people who are Quaker or frequently visit, like I identify as somebody who frequently attends. I'm an attender. And then there are people who are traveling through the area, or they're at the New York Yearly Meeting Retreat Center, Powell House across the road, and they come over for meeting for worship. And so then we've got people that will show up from D.C. or Oregon or out of the country.
We've had people as far away as India and Japan.
Right, and you might only meet them once. And so the meeting community itself is always evolving. And then every time that we are listening for guidance and sharing what we receive, that's always new and different as well. And there's when a message is received, what we are to do is allow ourselves to take that in and take the time to really let it kind of sink in and sort of reflect and ponder and receive it. And so there's a purposeful gap that's left before someone else will stand up and share a message. So it doesn't turn into, again, a discussion, right? And it's not like if, Kieran, if you were to stand up and share a message, then I'm necessarily going to respond to what you said. I might, you know, respond with an entirely new message. And that's really kind of more of the form of it, is each person listening for any guidance that Spirit, I would say, is wanting to deliver to the community. And one of the most radical things about Quakers, which is why George Fox partly spent so much time in prison, is that it's a direct relationship with the divine. It's a direct relationship with the sacred and the spirit, whatever the person calls that. And he was persecuted, from what I understand, for a large part because he didn't say, you know, you have to go through me, or you have to go through the priests, or you have to go through some spiritual hierarchy, religious hierarchy in order to connect with the sacred or the divine. He said everyone has that ability to connect directly themselves, which was, we might think that's really common now. That was heresy. That was actually heresy. That's one of the reasons people did get their heads lopped off. And there's a basic Quaker belief of there is that of God in everyone.
In George Fox's time, it was heresy because the king was the head of the Church of England. And so if you tried to do an end run around the Church of England, you were against the king, which, think about that for a minute. I mean, if you had to, I don't know, do something with the federal government, for example, before you could pray or do something religious here in this country, I mean, that's unheard of. We're so used to having religious freedom enshrined in the Constitution.
Yeah, he was one step below God, the divine right of kings, right? He was the one step down, and people believed that. Yeah. Well, many people believed that, at least.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, the history is fascinating. And here we are, a Quaker meeting. I have many family connections to the American Friends Service Committee, and have been on the front lines with them at protests. And one of my favorite Quakers of all times is a woman named Frances Crowe from Northampton, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. She's about 90 years old now, and she's still getting arrested. For what she terms disturbing the war.
Oh, that's great.
And that's great.
Wasn't she arrested recently? And when they asked her why she was getting arrested, she said something like, "I'm just getting started."
That sounds like her. That sounds like her. They sentenced her in 2003 after the start of the Iraq War in Northampton to community service or something, which is so funny because of what she does anyways, feeding the poor and all that. But she wore an orange jumpsuit sweeping the streets of Northampton with a sign on her front and back saying, "Sentenced for disturbing the war."
Oh,
and with
so
a broom
great.
In her hand, 85 years old, you know, sweeping the sidewalks and, of course, talking to everyone who would come her way.
Yeah, the best media coverage possible, right?
But it's pretty incredible, this tradition of nonviolence, civil disobedience, direct action, speaking truth to power, of questioning war, encouraging others to resist war. This is what the Quakers have been about. It's a wonderful tradition. So this play on Sunday the 18th is happening at Powell House, across the street from Powell House. That's 539 County Route 13. Is that what
yes.
I wrote?
Yeah.
In Old Chatham. It starts at 1:45 before there is a potluck at 12:45. I have Joseph and Phoenix here in the studio with me talking about this one-man show by Michael Mears called This Evil Thing. And I just want to say, could we just clarify a little bit, what is conscientious objection? I mean, I am what they call a CO, conscientious objector.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something you do when you turn 18 to avoid the draft. I just want to tell one story of me signing that big giant book at the Peace Abbey in Massachusetts. And as my witness right there was this tall, looming figure of Howard Zinn is signed next to my name as my witness for conscientious objector. That's that's on record right there. Rest in peace, Howard Zinn.
My hero.
It's just something you do for your consciousness and your commitment to not killing your brother. So is this still an option for people? Can they sign? Can they become conscious objectors? Do you know much about it? Or
I know a little bit about it.
Okay.
I know that when I turned 18, I had to sign a selective service registration card and hand it in at the post office.
Mm.
And luckily, when I was in high school, I had a close friend who was an English teacher who taught at a Quaker boarding school, who talked to me about conscientious objection, and he raised it by sharing Slaughterhouse-Five with me. And when I turned 18, I decided to go ahead and sign the Selective Service Registration card, but across the face of it, I just wrote two words, "I object." And when I handed it to the clerk, he saw that I had defaced the card, and he tried to hand it back to me. He says, you can't do that. And I just pushed it across the counter to him, and I said, "I believe I just did." And I walked out. And that's a form of conscientious objection.
Hmm.
And the thing is, we don't have a draft now. So you've got to sign up for this thing. Otherwise, if you're a young person, you won't be able to get student loans. And there's all kinds of financial and legal repercussions to it. But I think the most important thing for young people to know is that there needs to be a record. You can't just say, like, if a war breaks out, "Oh, I'm against war." It's too late. You want to create a record. And when I was in my 40s, I knew this father who had two young boys, and we knew that something was going to happen in the Middle East. And one of the things that we did was we had the boys write letters to their elected representatives, send certified mail, and they collected basically a portfolio of their belief system, so that if they were ever called up in a draft, they could go to the draft board and they could say, "Look, this is not something that we just decided a moment ago. This is something that we've been thinking about for some time. Mm. So very, very important to get that in writing and have documentation.
Because, I mean, it is possible they could just reinstate the draft for World War III. I mean, World War III is kind of broken out in some ways. It's pretty... We're fighting, I think, in how many countries now? We can't keep track, right?
A lot of countries.
It used to be only one war at a time back in 1991, the Iraq War. And then it just sort of... Things changed, and we just started going here and there and bombed this one, Afghanistan, Sudan, Somalia... And
then Yemen,
it just was
Libya.
Like, whoa, and now it just goes on and on and on.
Mission creep.
Yeah, yeah. So World War III, the draft could get reinstated for all folks, young folks out there. Get it on record.
Yeah.
Right?
Definitely. Definitely.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing this. This has been absolutely wonderful, and I just love the Quakers. I got to say that. You know, I don't
thank you.
Think they're doing... bad things out there. There's no finger on any nuclear button right there. And again, yeah, the 18th, this Sunday, 12:45, Powell House, Old Chatham, Michael Mears, one-man show, This Evil Thing. And you can imagine some of the dynamics, if you know history at all, World War I and World War II, and what these countries were going through nationalism in particular. The act of questioning your government in your country of going to war had to have been a brave act. I just can't imagine what these folks went through to object in that day and age to go into a war.
And, you know, before we close out, I would just say one last thing here, and that is people often bring up the question, well, you know, what would a pacifist do, you know, with the Nazis? And the Quaker answer to that is, you know, we seek a world... where there's shared security. And if you look historically at how the Nazi regime developed, it was because after World War I, we put such strict repayment measures on what was then Weimar Germany. And that's what led to the rise of Hitler. And if we had thought about it at that time, like how can we share security and prosperity, Hitler would have had no platform.
Yeah, Martin Luther King said, was it nonviolence or peace? Peace is not the absence of war. It is the presence of justice.
Amen, brother.
And there you go. You know, people don't want to talk about it, but Germany was absolutely destroyed after World War I. Its people just battered down, killed, as were many other countries. But Germany really got the short end of the stick on that one. And this Nazi movement started to develop out of fear, out of all sorts of things were happening that had the right people spoken up, had more people thought and acted like the Quakers during that time where the Nazis were starting to gain influence, it would have never happened. So you headed off at the pass through the presence of justice and shared security. People are scared. They just want to feel safe, right?
Yeah.
And you see it happening in this country where people are scared and just do the most ridiculous things, like say, we're going to ban these 2 billion people from entering the country based on their religion because we're scared. It's just, what? It's just mind-boggling, but that's where we're at right now. People are thinking that's an okay idea.
Yeah.
Because what are you going to do about terror?
Education. You can't base your foreign policy on a soundbite.
Or a tweet.
Oh,
yeah. I don't know. I think people are excited. Trump is going to visit Kim Jong-un, the leader of Korea, or so he claims. And people are like, yeah, this could be it. This could be a turning of a new consciousness. And I'm thinking that what if they become really good friends?
Like, an interesting
I don't
situation.
Know if that's a good thing. Like, we just got to keep an eye on it, guys. Let's just eyes wide open here, right?
Valid point.
It's like, Kim, me and you, we're actually the same guy. All right? Like, take a look. Like, you're this way, I'm that way, but really deep down, like, come on. You share some tips with me how you do it. I'll share some tips how I do it. Let's get together. Come on. We'll do something here.
We'll make a deal.
Yeah, come on. We'll do a big trade deal. Your top 1% versus mine. We'll all be in together. So here we digress. I digress. This is what I do. I turn left really easily, and there we go. So, wow. Well, once again, Joseph and Phoenix, thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, this is wonderful. Again, the show, Sunday the 18th, 12:45, Powerhouse, This Evil Thing, a one-man show. Check it out. Is there somewhere we can look it up online?
Yeah, I was looking at the website.
Old Chatham Quakers.
Yep.
Okay.
It'll be listed on our website, and we also have a blog on the website as well if people want to read up a little bit about what's going on in the meeting house.
Yep, and it's also listed on the WGXC calendar already.
Ooh, good for them.
Yeah.
Thank you, WGXC.
Yeah.